It's the middle of May, and it's still snowing up here in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. On the show this week, a deep dive into the history and archaeology of bear's ears. We'll talk to an archaeologist and curator, Jonathan Till, about his work in southern Utah. Plus, a patent that changed the West and global fashion this week in Western history. But first, let's start with the news. The White House may be in chaos because of Russia and Mike Flynn, but the Trump administration's assault on public lands is still going strong this week. On Thursday, we saw the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee take up the nomination of David Bernhardt as Deputy Interior Secretary. This is basically the chief operating officer of the department. The deputy secretary is responsible for day-to-day operations and decisions. It is a hugely important role. Now, David Bernhardt is, to put it simply, a walking conflict of interest. I've written a couple of pieces that get into why. There are links to those in the show notes. The whole list is way too long to get into without dedicating an entire podcast episode to just David Bernhardt, and maybe we'll do that someday. For now, I will list off just a few of the reasons. He's got connections to Jack Abramoff. You remember he's the crooked lobbyist who took down several members of Congress and the Deputy Interior Secretary back in the early 2000s. Bernhardt's lobbying firm is knee-deep in the proposed Cadiz Water Pipeline, which would pump water out of the Mojave Desert into Southern California. If that project goes forward, Bernhardt's lobbying firm would make millions and probably tens of millions of dollars in stock that it would receive from Cadiz. Bernhardt has been a lawyer for Statoil, Norway's state-owned oil company. We don't know what kind of work he did, but Statoil has its fingers in projects all around the world, from Iran to Azerbaijan to China, plus a development deal with Rosneft, the Russian state-owned oil company. The list of conflicts goes on and on and on, dozens of clients over the years, and all David Bernhardt will do is promise to sit on the sidelines for 1 year if any of those companies come across his desk at Interior. That's a joke, folks. A one-year timeout is nothing, considering that important decisions at Interior can take years to happen. That Cadiz project, the water pipeline, has been in the works for more than 20 years. And David Bernhardt leaves himself room to get waivers from the Trump administration if he just can't wait that full year to jump in anyway. And those ethics waivers are not public. The Trump administration isn't posting them online. That comes to us from Juliet Alperin at The Washington Post, who's got a piece on all of the public information that is disappearing from the internet under the Trump administration. So that Senate committee did not vote after David Bernhardt's hearing yesterday. We will soon find out which members are on board with those kinds of conflicts and who draws the line. Our guest this week is Jonathan Till, an archaeologist who is based out of Bluff, Utah. You know, we asked around, and the consensus was that when you want to know about the archaeology and history of southern Utah, Jonathan is the guy to talk to, so we called him up. Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
One of the things we've all heard about Bear's Ears and the Cedar Mesa region of Utah is the staggering number of archaeological sites. I mean, tens of thousands of them. How do you even come up with a number like that?
Well, it's based on sampling. Right now we know that we have at least 30,000 archaeological sites. It's really more like 35,000 numbers or sites right now that have been recorded for San Juan County. That's the county in which the Bear's Ears monument occurs. We know that there are tens of thousands of other sites that are undocumented out there. And we come up with these numbers essentially by, to some degree, there's some sampling involved. So that is, we look at a chunk of land and say, okay, well, this square mile has 100 sites recorded in it. Therefore, it seems reasonable to presume that the sections around it have that many sites in it, too. And when you crunch numbers like that, you can gradually generate or come up with an understanding for how many sites are out here. The upshot is that there are tens of thousands of sites out here. I've seen a number floated for 100,000 sites. That's possible. It's possible that the site could be a little higher. It's possible that the number could be a little bit lower than that.
So basically, you've got lifetimes worth of research and archaeology that you could study in this area.
That's right. There's been some research that's been conducted out here, and those research projects have allowed us to generate some pretty reasonable numbers.
So let's go way back then. How long have people been living around Bears Ears in Cedar Mesa?
Well, we have evidence for the best patterned archaeological complex here, and that is the Clovis complex. So, Clovis technology points that are associated with mammoth and mastodon and other megafauna at the end of the Pleistocene, the end of the Ice Age. So we know that folks have been around here at least that long.
And then its settlements, at what point did they turn into the kinds of permanent settlements that we see in the cliff dwellings and the other ruins that are still there?
Sure. Usually, we have thousands of years of occupation or use of the landscape by archaic hunters and gatherers. And right around 2000 BC or 1500, that's when we first start to see the earliest good evidence of agriculture around these parts, and that is to say that we get corn, harking back that early. But right around here in southeastern Utah, we have really good evidence for relatively large numbers of these early farmers that span the time of 300 BC to AD 300.
So basically 10,000 years of people and 2,000 years of human settlement?
Yeah, roughly. Maybe 3,000.
Maybe 3,000?
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. A lot of listeners of this podcast are probably familiar with Mesa Verde National Park and the absolutely tremendous cliff dwellings there. How does the history of Bears Ears fit in with the history at Mesa Verde?
Oh,
a couple hundred miles apart,
that's
right?
That's a great question, and that landscape that spans the Bears Ears all the way, or rather the Cedar Mesa, which is at the foot of the Bears Ears, the southern foot of the Bears Ears, Cedar Mesa on over to Mesa Verde. Archaeologists think about that chunk of country as really one representing one archaeological tradition, the Mesa Verde tradition. We could call it Mesa Verde tradition, or we could call it the Cedar Mesa tradition. Mm-hmm. I joke with my colleagues at Mesa Verde that really they're just the eastern end of the Cedar Mesa region.
So if you look geographically, then Cedar Mesa is more at the middle of where the overall settlements were in the Four Corners area?
It's really the kind of the western edge, the western margin. Yeah, so Cedar Mesa is on the west edge, and Mesa Verde is on the east edge. And all that country in between is a chucky jam full of evidence of these early farmers and villagers.
So that gets to the overall scale here of the region that we're talking about, stretching across Colorado, southern Utah. How much of a challenge is it protecting all of these archaeological sites?
I can imagine that it's a huge challenge. I'm not engaged in that particular effort myself, but I have friends and colleagues who do have that as their job, and it's a real tough thing because it spans a huge chunk of country, and you're talking about several different entities that manage those lands. So BLM, Forest Service, and different BLM offices and different Forest Service offices, and of course you have the around here. It's mostly the Navajo Nation with tribal lands that are also enter into that mix. And of course, you have state lands too.
So that brings up a good question. How closely do you work with tribes when you're doing field work or excavations?
Well, it depends on the nature of the work and who's conducting it and what the circumstances are. So if you have a public project, you know, something that's taking place on public lands or with public monies, especially state or federal funds, then there are hooks in that process that mandate that we work with interested tribes or pueblos. I think anybody who's engaged in archaeology, in the work of archaeology out here, should be talking with American Indian folks. If you don't, you're really kind of missing some of, I think, the best lines of data or evidence, things that let us know how to consider or think about the artifacts, objects, or architecture that we're working with.
So what is that study process like for you as part of your job when you're either leading excavation or research work? Just walk us through that.
Well, first of all, you have to understand that I'm a curator. I'm a curator at the Edge of the Cedars State Park Museum, and I am an archaeologist because our museum works with mostly the deep history of American Indian peoples. An archaeologist is probably the best fit for the job of curator. Right now, I'm working on a very small exhibit that addresses the ruins right outside our museum's walls. And as I'm coming up with the text for this exhibit, I lean against a person or two from the Hopi tribe for advice, a relatively informal consultation. It's not something that I have to do, but I think that the exhibit would be impoverished without that informed perspective that in this case a Pueblo person can bring to this particular subject.
So what are your research priorities then, or exhibit priorities right now that you're working on besides that one you've got in the process?
The kinds of things that I'm working at right now the museum are actually kind of, it's an interesting scattershot of things. So one of the things that I do for Utah State Parks is, as a permitted archaeologist, is that I work on projects as they come necessary on state parks lands. So, for example, we have a bicycle trail that's going in just south of Cedar Mesa, you know, in the very southern end of the monument, mm-hmm. as it's designated now. So I conducted survey on those lands and recorded a number of archaeological sites. In this case, because we're not doing any excavation, there's not the mandate to do consultation. Should there be excavation, you're darn tootin' that we would talk with native folks. We certainly don't expect to do that kind of work for just the development of a bicycle trail. That's sure. That's just not going to happen. Yeah.
We've talked a bit about the scale and the sheer number of sites. If you had an unlimited budget, unlimited staff, where would you go first to focus your research energy?
Yeah, if I were a field archaeologist, and if I were, let's just pluck me out of the museum environment here for the time being, I certainly have research interests above and beyond what I do at the edge of the Cedars. But if I were to, do work outside the office, I would probably look at unrecorded or undocumented sites that are associated with the so-called Chaco phenomenon. That's been a big research interest of mine for a long time. And it's also an amazing aspect, just one little element of the complicated history out here.
What is that, the Chaco phenomenon?
Yeah, the Chaco phenomenon. It's back about 1,000 years ago in the late 1000s, there was this really kind of interesting outpouring of ideas from Chaco Canyon, which is located in northwestern New Mexico. And it's about 140 miles from where I'm sitting right now in my office in Blanding, Utah. Outside our doors at the edge of the Cedars, we have a Great House Pueblo. It's one of about 25 sites that we know of that dial into those fantastic and powerful sensibilities that exist down in Chaco Canyon. Down there, those folks had, we have evidence of some of the perhaps most monumental Puebloan architecture in the Southwest. We have, for example, at Pueblo Bonito, at least four stories, if not five stories, of architecture there, 800 plus rooms. It was one of the largest buildings in North America.
That's
probably
huge.
And it was one of the largest buildings in North America until the advent of the 20th century. We have smaller versions of those things scattered throughout southeastern Utah. We're kind of more on the, the kind of country bumpkin level of Chaco out here. We're still tapped into those huge ideas and expansive ideas that Chaco so well represents. So up here, when we see a site that harks back to those Chacoan sensibilities, they usually have these multiple-story buildings with a lot of masonry. You have large subterranean round rooms, or which we call great kivas, and then these monumental alignments that we've designated as roads. It's these huge constructions that would have necessitated organized and massive amounts of labor that have really captured my imagination as well as the imagination of other folks working in the prehistory of this place.
When you say roads, how big are we talking?
So these roads are, again, you got to take what archaeologists call things with a grain of salt. These roads are about 25 to 30 feet wide.
That's road width.
Yeah, and they're usually excavated into the ground, they can extend for a couple of miles around these parts. Sometimes these roads really are associated only with great houses, but in other cases, they seem to connect real important places on the landscape, built places with other built places or with natural features. So, for example, the Bluff Great House down in Bluff, Utah, has a road that seems to be associated with it that is oriented with the Bear's Ears. Those orientations might be captured in other ways, too. So, for example, here at the edge of the Cedars, our great house also has an orientation with the Bear's Ears, but it's more along the lines of an alignment In this case, it's an equinox alignment. So when the sun sets on the equinox from the edge of the Cedars Great House, it sets behind the Bear's Ears here. So,
oh, cool.
There are different ways of tapping into these tremendous landscape features. One way is by road, another way is by these solar alignments.
So if you had a time machine and could go back several hundred or thousand years, what is it that you would want to know that you could never really be quite sure about studying these cultures a thousand years later?
Ah, man. One of the things that's been burning in my head of late is an apparent dearth of evidence for people being here in the first half of the 700s. We have lots of folks here in the Four Corners area all throughout the AD 600s. That 7th century was a really marvelous time for farmers and early villagers here in southeastern Utah and in southwestern Colorado. But in the first half of the 700s, nothing. We have very little evidence for anybody doing anything out here. And then when with the advent of the 750s or 760s, we start seeing folks coming back to the area, evidently, and doing something entirely different from what they were doing in the 600s. These folks in the 700s were building villages in which they were living essentially cheek to jowl with each other. They were making redware pottery. They had different kinds of pit houses. So I guess I'd like to know if my assumption that the neighborhood is empty in the early 700s is correct, first of all. And then if it is, and I think it probably is, I'd like to know where those folks in the mid-700s come from. Were they related to the people that were here in the 600s? How was it that they came about to being these cheek-to-jowl villagers, right? These folks who were living in the first apparent pueblos out here. How did that happen, and why did that happen? What were the circumstances surrounding that, and where did that practice come into being?
Very cool. Last question. Since now I really want to head out there like next week and come see you and your museum and the region out there. Do you have a favorite spot or two that you recommend folks see first when they come to Bear's Ears in the Cedar Mesa region?
Yeah, I do. Well, first of all, our museum.
That's a gimme. Yes, definitely come to the museum.
That's a good place to start because we have a developed set of ruins here for folks to put their eyes on and to think about, and of course the objects that go with those ruins, as well as the larger landscape out here. So there is that. But another really good place to start one's exploration is down around Bluff. At Sand Island, which is the river put in for the San Juan River, and there's a set of spectacular rock art panels there that have images in them that span this whole swath of time that we've been talking about, especially the farmer time. So stuff from the early days of farming, things from 2,500 years ago, and then things from that later Pueblo period that we were talking about during the Chaco era, say, during the 1000s, but also rock art from folks that are here historically, we know, so Navajo and Ute folks as well. So it's really a place that kind of ties everything together, both Pueblo, Navajo, Ute, and Paiute, and puts it all into one package.
I love it. Jonathan Till is an archaeologist and curator at Edge of the Cedars State Park Museum in Blanding. He does work based out of Bluff, Utah as well. Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to join the podcast today.
Hey, my pleasure. You're very welcome.
All right, I will just note that Jonathan, as a state employee, has no opinion on Bears Ears National Monument itself. We do thank him so much for sharing all of his knowledge with us. Now, we here at the Center for Western Priorities, of course, do have an opinion on Bears Ears. You probably do as well. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke opened up an incredibly short 15-day comment period for the public to weigh in on the possibility of President Trump erasing or shrinking the national monument. That comment period closes on Friday, May 26th. Now, that comes just after his 4-day trip to Utah, where he spent only 90 minutes with supporters of both Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. The rest of the time, he traveled around, went hiking, all with monument opponents. So this is your chance to make your voice heard online. You can go to regulations.gov to do that. It is kind of tricky to navigate. And also the government is, hey, we're shutting down that website for comments this Saturday. Great timing, guys. So instead, I recommend going to monumentsforall.org. They're collecting comments there, and we'll pass them all on to the Department of the Interior. The advantage of using that site is that, first of all, it doesn't go down for scheduled maintenance, and secondly, this way monument supporters also have a record of all those comments in case anything was to, let's say, happen to the supportive comments on the official government website. The deadline for comments about Bears Ears is, again, next Friday, May 26th. Not much time. Go leave your comments right now. We will be keeping an eye on them all as well. We always like to wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. Of course, Mount St. Helens erupted this week, May 18th, 1980. But we're going farther back to 1873 and a patent that changed the world. It's called Improvement in Fastening Pocket Openings. Boy, that's exciting! It was the idea of Jacob Davis, a tailor in Reno, Nevada. He made work pants. And rather than just stitching, he added metal rivets on the stress points to make them stronger. Those stress points were at the corners of the pockets and the base of the button fly. Davis had the method, but he didn't have the money for the patent paperwork. So he wrote a letter to a man named Levi Strauss, suggesting that Levi put up the money and they get the patent together. Strauss just sold dry goods at the time. He imported fabric and sold it to boom towns across the West, which is how he knew Davis. Now, with that patent, he started making what he called waist overalls out of heavy canvas. Jacob Davis became his production manager, and after a few years, they switched from canvas to heavyweight blue denim, and blue jeans were born. Blue jeans, patented this week in 1873. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. If you like what you hear, please go leave us a review on iTunes. That is the best way for listeners to find the podcast. You can also find us on Google Play, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm partial to an Android app called Pocket Casts myself. We love email, too. podcast@westernpriorities.org is where to send your love letters and hate mail. We will be back in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, go fill out those comments about our national monuments. There's a link in the show notes. On behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks again to our guest, Jonathan Till. My name is Aaron Weiss, and thanks for listening.